Shalom and welcome to another edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address. These podcasts are presented to help explore the impact of the longevity revolution on our congregations and our community. And we invite you to visit our website, jewishsacredaging.com, as well as the Jewish Sacred Aging Facebook page. If you'd like to make a comment or a suggestion for us, you can go to the website, jewishsacredaging.com, and leave even a voicemail message on the voicemail icon, which is located on the home page. And it is with great pleasure and honor that we welcome to the microphone on this edition of Seekers of Meaning, Dr. Jonathan Marino, who is the David and Lynn Silfen University Professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and here to talk about his new book, co-authored with Dr. Amy Gutman, who is the president of Penn, University of Pennsylvania, with this great title, one of the great book titles I've run into, Everybody Wants to Go to Heaven, but Nobody Wants to Die, subtitled Bioethics and the Transformation of Healthcare in America. That's so cool. Dr. Marino, welcome to Seekers of Meaning. How are you doing?
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's really a pleasure to speak with you. And this is a fantastic book. I really enjoyed reading it. Talk to me a little bit about the genesis of this book. You know, how did it come to be? Bioethics seems to be very hot right now. It's a hot topic.
Indeed. Hot topic. It's one that you and I have sort of lived through. And a lot of the book is about the way that the field of bioethics has, as I would put it, tracked the development of the public conversation and sometimes heated debate about moral values in the life sciences and in medical care. We got interested in doing something together, Dr. Gutman and me, because we had worked together for President Obama on his bioethics commission, which Dr. Gutman chaired, and for which I was senior advisor. You know, we understood the way each of us thought and worked, because we worked closely together on a number of the commission reports. I had been a faculty member a few years before that at Penn, but I was chosen by the staff, senior, the director of the commission, the staff director, to be a senior consultant. It happened that I was also a professor at Penn. So in this process, I got to know Amy and she me well. And when that was over, it seemed natural for us to make the final step of collecting our thoughts about what bioethics has become in the last 40 or 50 years, and to some degree, at least, how a couple of the commission reports were part of that history.
There's a paralleling to the whole growth and interest of this, of course, within the Jewish world. The Jewish bioethics group has grown tremendously from one, and a lot more writing across the denominational line.
Yes, it has. And although neither of us put ourselves forward as Jewish scholars, I should say, although we're both Jewish, we have been both of us keenly aware of the, as you say, burgeoning literature in the rabbinical community. In a response, like the secular world, and I should say like other religious communities, particularly, of course, the Roman Catholics, and to some extent also the Islamic world, in response to some of the same forces in the last 50 years or so that have stimulated a bigger conversation in secular terms. And those forces include the growth of technologies that can change life or delay death, and the different options that people have in the course of medical care, and also, you know, among other things, the cost of medical care. Of special interest to Jews is the fact that so much of the way we think about medical ethics is a result of the Holocaust and the concentration camp experiments, a topic that I've worked on a lot. So the Jewish community has a special reason to be interested in medical ethics. Obviously, Jews are especially highly represented in the medical sciences and research, as well as in the clinic. But our book is not does not purport, as you well know, to be a review of Jewish medical ethics.
No, I know.
It's
but
it's really trying to take account of so many influences and topics in the field in the last 50 years.
And it opens the door. The book opens the door to a lot of interesting conversation. And I know as I go around for Jewish Sacred Aging to congregations, the need to educate our people who really, I don't think, are aware of the many of the linkages between what's happening medical technology-wise in this area and Jewish texts and how Jewish texts have been used and are still being used to interpret and massage new things, that the need to educate people in congregations has never been more important because of this growth in medical technology. So the technology keeps pushing the envelope, doesn't it? Keeps pushing the envelope, going to the frontier, almost as if it's dragging society behind it. Is that an accurate description?
Yeah, I think that's true. And it's true not only in an obviously, you know, moral sense. You think just for example about the development of advanced cardiac life support, which came around in the late 50s, early 60s. And now by the 70s, you have what are called crash carts. I'm sure you know, you have attended patients in hospitals, and you know what I'm talking about. They're all over the place. And one of the early topics in clinical medical ethics, the hospital-based medical ethics, was the fact that the ability to extend life, or the ability to do very strenuous interventions, and you know, shockingly so for people who had not seen them before, just intensified so much in the 70s. And so one of the big topics in the secular world, as well as in the faith communities in the 70s, and as you well know, was how far one should go. The name that will ring a bell with certainly with your viewer, your audience of a certain age, and people who live in the Northeast, is that of Karen Ann Quinlan, the young woman who was in a persistent vegetative state for 9.5 years with artificial feeding, whose parents had received permission from the church to withdraw her ventilator, the breathing machine, because she had entered a vegetative state, they did not think it was God's will for her to continue to be on the ventilator, but they did not want to starve her to death. So she was kept on tube feeding for 9.5 years. And that moment in 1975, when many people said, well, this is an unconscious woman who gets to have what her parents think is what she would want, and yet there are people like me who are still cognitive and sapient who don't get that chance. So this stimulated, ironically, a big conversation about informed consent, as well as about death and dying.
In one of the chapters in the book, you talk about significant aspects of healthcare, and I think the last statistics I saw recently was that 18% of the gross national product of the United States is dealing with expenditures for healthcare. Yeah. And then you talk about something called the ethical obligation. I think it's on page 127. Does society have this ethical obligation to provide access to healthcare to every citizen?
Well, we think that an affluent society like ours does. And if you think about the federal law in the 1940s after World War II, that required emergency rooms, you know, to admit everybody who needed emergency care, because those departments were being built with public funds, and that was a move in the direction of requiring a decent minimum level of health care for everybody. But it's clearly not enough. Medicare and Medicaid made an enormous difference in the mid '60s. You know, people our age had parents who might well have had to pauperize themselves in those days in order to take care of a very ill older person or a younger person. And we just forget how much of a difference Medicare made. People expected in the mid 1960s that there would be, you know, the next step towards some kind of universal health care. There was a presidential ethics commission in the early 80s that came close to declaring that there was a right to health care, which rights language is very strong language, would have meant that government had an obligation to deliver on that right. It didn't quite get there. And now we're struggling with what economists predicted in the 1980s, that the current level of spending, to a great extent, again, because of investments in technology, which we Americans love, was going to drag us, you know, kicking and screaming, perhaps, in this direction. And now we can expect more than 20% of GDP in the next few years being spent on healthcare. So it's an unsustainable course. And although, you know, there are various of the candidates now have their views, this is just going to be, this is going to be forced on the next 10, 20 years. Something is going to have to happen. Now, I will say that to some extent, as you said, you know, technology has pulled these ethical issues in its wake. It's also pulled the spending in its wake. And there's a lot of unfortunate spending, unneeded spending on the technologies in the hospitals, because frankly, those are big capital expenses that have to be satisfied.
Is that what some people who write in the literature on this subject called futile care?
So futility is a vexed language, because there are so many definitions of futility. In the most raw sense, medical futility means I could do this, but it won't change the imminent outcome. That would be, you know, truly futile care, or truly futile intervention, like giving antibiotics for a viral, you know, for a viral cold. It's not going to make any difference. And as you probably know, doctors are discouraged now from doing that, but they sometimes still do, just to get their patients out of the office with something. So that's really medically futile. It happens that antibiotics for a virus, you know, that's not a big deal, except ecologically it is a big deal. Creates more antibiotic resistance. But what's a big deal is when you try to do a maneuver that you know will not work imminently. That's futile. But there's also useless care or useless interventions. And I will tell you the story. This happened to me just last week. A relative who's 80 years old, a woman, perfectly fine. Her doctor said, you know, we have this CAT scan that your insurance will cover for your brain, and you might find it interesting. So she said, okay. And then as so many of us, before we have a medical procedure of any kind, although she had no problem, she got nervous. You know, what could they find? What would they find? What if they did find something? Well, turned out they didn't find anything. But when she told me the story, I got very upset, as did a couple of colleagues I mentioned it to, because a CAT scan for an otherwise healthy 80-year-old person is not only useless, and it's a waste of money, a waste of time. And if something was found, some people call these incidental findings, even if it was a false positive, it would have created a cascade of further interventions that she didn't need. So there is, unfortunately, a lot of this going on. Technology creates the conditions under which people want to use it.
And technology seems to, it's almost as if we worship it
it has become a kind of holy grail.
Yeah, it's almost like an idolatrous way. You know, there's got to be a test,
Well, yeah, and physicians understandably love the numbers.
Right.
They want to, you know, let's test and test and test. I heard some years ago, before I was at the University of Pennsylvania, I was at the University of Virginia. I used to go to the morbidity and mortality and pathology conferences, and I heard one physician saying while showing some slides of a patient's internal organs, well, this is what we do, and this is what we do in this case, and this is what we do in this case. And one of the senior colleagues from the front row said, Tom, she's dead. You know, keep doing testing at some point. So it has become kind of a holy grail. It is a particularly American phenomenon, I think. You talk to Canadians, you talk to Brits, other people in Western Europe, they don't have the same attitude toward technology that we do.
We're speaking with Dr. Jonathan Marino, the co-author with Dr. Amy Gutman of this very, very exciting new book, Everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die. Bioethics and the transformation of healthcare in America. We'll include the contact information for the book in the show notes for this particular edition of Seekers of Meaning. Dr. Marino, I remember a few years ago reading a book by Daniel Callahan, I think from the Hastings Center, talking about rationing. And then lo and behold, in the book, in the middle of the book, you write about something called artificial scarcity and rationing. Could you just elaborate that on the ethical issues? And this is happening now, and you kind of, I think you kind of alluded to it in the last little statement.
Yeah. Well, I should say, first of all, Dan was my boss at the Hastings Center, the first bioethics think tank. I worked there in the mid-1980s, and Dan died just a few months ago. Dan took some pretty tough positions on these issues. He talked about the technological imperative. He talked about what he thought was the intergenerational injustice of older people insisting on high-technology medicine after a certain point, depriving the system and therefore indirectly of younger, more healthy people of access to that time and technology, and those resources. And in bioethics, we do talk about scarcity. There's natural scarcity, which is the scarcity of biological organs. And then there's artificial scarcity, which is the kind of scarcity that's the result of decisions that human systems make about what people can get and what they can't. And the most vivid example of this that we talk about in the book from the 1960s and early 1970s was the shortage of kidney dialysis machines. That was corrected through an exception that we still have to Medicare so that you don't have to be over 65 to get access to dialysis if you need it. Everybody who has end-stage renal disease can get kidney dialysis, hopefully before you have a kidney transplant. That the goal really is has been was originally to make dialysis a bridge to transplant. But here's a perverse result of this great success. It works well enough so that a couple of companies have 70% of the business for kidney dialysis. And you may have passed some of these companies' buildings. Often they're in pretty rough neighborhoods because they like the low rent. And because this works well enough, there's been essentially no advance in the technology of end-stage renal disease, sort of transplant. So we're kind of stuck because there's no incentive to improve the technology. It's not. You know, it's really hard. You have to be on hours a day, several times a week on dialysis. So there's now a push, as you probably know, to do more dialysis at home. And at least there are some pilot projects to do that. Oddly enough, there are pilot projects the Trump administration has instituted under Obamacare, which the administration is trying to destroy. So we do have these paradoxical discourses, right? In public policy. But that's a good example, dialysis machine, a good example of artificial scarcity that we addressed. But there's a lot of other artificial scarcity that we have not addressed, particularly in public health. And as you know from looking at the book, we are really concerned about public mental health, which has been a terrible failure since the 1970s with deinstitutionalization and the failure to create institutions for the seriously mentally ill. Although we do have them, and they're called prisons. 20-25% of people in prisons have a serious mental illness.
You know, you mentioned the mental illness thing, and as I travel and I've done some work with the Alzheimer's Association, the figures that they keep putting out about the fact that as the baby boomers age out, the instances of Alzheimer's is going to go from like currently about 5 million to about 15. Talking about scarcity and rationing, and everybody I've talked to, geriatricians, nurses, keep telling us healthcare providers, there just aren't going to be enough people to take care of us as this thing continues to grow as the baby boomers age. Where that's sort of like an implicit rationing, isn't it? I mean, is
it is. You know, the economists will say, well, we ration by price.
Yeah.
You know, there are goods that people want, and some people have the money to get those things and other people don't. So rationing happens by, you know, and from the economist's point of view, it happens by price. It also, though, is, you know, extremely contingent. It depends very much on what your wherewithal is. As you may have seen a piece a couple of days ago in, I think it was the Times, that New York Times, that described the way that more people are now dying at home.
Yes,
than they are in hospitals.
Right.
I'm sure you noticed that, and that's a big change in the last 4 or 5 years. Since World War II, most people have died in America in hospitals. So people, you know, are more aware of, and we would argue, based on the book, want more control over the last part of their lives. And so it's, you know, you don't want to be in an ICU with bells ringing and people going in and out all the time, an impersonal environment. You want to be at home. I completely understand that. But as the piece indicated, there are far fewer resources available at home, and an elderly spouse or your children, who are not healthcare professionals, may not be prepared for the problems of dying people at home, or people with dementia being kept at home. So yeah, this is a terrible problem. It's one of the reasons that even both political parties back in 2013 agreed to create the Federal Brain Initiative, because there's really not good science right now about dementias, and there needs to be more basic science done, which is being done now, to try to understand dementias, including Alzheimer's. But that will take time. And meanwhile, as you say, there are insufficient facilities and providers, particularly for people who don't have the assets, don't have the family. You know, it's really terrible. And it's going to contribute to the numbers we mentioned earlier, right? The unsustainable growth of the cost of healthcare.
The income inequality is a real ethical issue, isn't it, for our society?
Yeah, it is. And although we hear a lot about it, you know, in more general terms, that it's bad for a democratic society to have such inequality. We don't think of it often in very concrete terms. Just, you know, how do you manage the last weeks, months, or sometimes even years with somebody who has a serious medical problem?
Right. You mentioned before this issue of control, and it's something that I'm fascinated by only because a lot of the work that we do in Jewish Sacred Aging is dealing with baby boomers and our families. And look, this is a generation that was used to controlling things through the pipeline of our own growth from the 60s up to now. And the whole end of life issue and the medical aid in dying bills that are now law. And I live in New Jersey, and obviously it's now law in the state of New Jersey. My sense is that it's the baby boom generation who's driven this engine, because we want to seek some sort of control, as you seem to have alluded to before. And I just like to ask you to comment on this current desire and legislative push to exercise more and more control. I want greater autonomy. I want greater control. I don't want to be alone at the end. And could you deal with this in the book, the Brittany Maynard thing, and in the book, could you just walk us through a little bit about how you approach this?
Well, you know, how did we get here? We got here partly, again, because of the technology. A Princeton theologian in the early 70s said that, you know, even by the early 70s, we have halfway technologies. You know, you can sustain somebody's life, but you can't get them back to their previous quality of life. And so we've seen that for decades, people, you know, who are approximately our age. We've also seen people die in hospitals and nursing homes. Sometimes our parents or other elderly relatives. And I think, again, they're dying and surrounded by technology in ways that previous generations of people in their 60s, 50s, 60s, 70s had not seen other people dying that way. So that has that and the popular culture of illustrating what it's like to be in a hospital when you're dying. I think there are many influences here, and the more cultural, general cultural influence that I think you're also alluding to, the sort of the Woodstock generation wants to decide, you know, when it listens to the music and where, right? And we are, you know, I'm 67. There's never been a better time to be alive in a better place than America in the 67 years of my life. We are well aware of how fortunate we are. So all of those are factors. Now, if you talk to people, and I have close friends who work on palliative care and who work in public policy, they will say they don't like these new legal arrangements, assisted death arrangements, because we don't have a surrounding healthcare system that can make sure that people don't feel they have to do this. That's a powerful argument, right? The argument that it's immoral to put people in the position where they feel they need to have a physician assistance in ending their lives early because the healthcare system has failed and doesn't provide the kind of palliation and comfort that they want. So they don't want to wait. And yet, people who have seen what it's like to die in a hospital don't want that, and they don't want it. And now we know, of course, as you have said, that people were so good at people keeping people alive into their 80s, 90s, that you're going to have two or three major medical problems when you get to that age. And this is, as you say, a generation of control freaks. I'm going to put that word in your mouth. So we've got this perfect set of circumstances that have led us to this point.
How do we educate? I mean, you're an educator. How do we raise this to the people in the pew, so to speak, or to the average person saying, look, these are some of these issues that you really, really, really do need to take a look at, because eventually they're going to come to you or members of your family, guaranteed.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that when I started really late 70s, early 80s in bioethics, we thought, well, people are having a hard time filling out these forms and, you know, letting people know what their preferences are and the end of life and so forth. But eventually they will, and eventually the culture will pick up on this. And still, it's still true that, and I'm sure you've experienced this with the people that you help to take care of, there's still people who were really reluctant to talk about this.
Oh, yes.
and reluctant to talk about it with their family members. And I find that sort of fascinating because we are, you know, we do like to think that we're going to live forever somehow, or at least many of us do. So that's one area in which we have not, I think, made a whole lot of progress. And that's a little frustrating because so many issues that I confronted when I was doing hospital ethics, sort of bedside ethics years ago, you know, have to do with the failure of communication. It's a cliche, but it happens to be a true one. Many of the ethics consults I did in hospitals really had to do with families that had not talked about this,
right,
and did not know what their loved one wanted. But you know, those were not really ethical issues; those were communications issues. And on many occasions, we sat around together and we figured it out. Wasn't a big philosophical enterprise, but that is still, yeah, that's still an area that I think we need to improve. And yet popular culture is already doing that to some extent, right? Because people know about Brittany Maynard and people are making decisions now. Those who are thinking about it are thinking about it, I think, in my experience, quite deeply and earnestly. But it is still an area where we need to do better.
In your experience and what's the role, in your opinion, in the whole bioethics conversation moving forward, of the role of spirituality and faith communities?
The places I've worked in clinical ethics have always had access to a chaplain. And if there was a case in which there was not a chaplain or was somehow felt to be inappropriate to have that person, we always that one of the first two or three questions you ask in an ethics consult, this is my experience as somebody who used to do this, is what's the religious orientation? Is there a spiritual advisor? That can be just tremendously helpful, partly because, you know, they're sort of they can be a trusted individual in a system that is so, particularly if you're in a hospital, you know, it's so imposing. Somebody who's not in a white coat and is not seen as part of the system or the establishment, that can be a big help. And so I participated for years at Penn in training the chaplains. This is still when I was more interested in clinical ethics. And, you know, I think we need to, our programs for teaching bioethics to chaplains are not as, I would like them to be a little more vigorous than they are, because I found the chaplains were tremendously interested in these topics, and they often did not have time set aside to read in the bioethics literature per se, and to talk to people in bioethics. So I would want to see more of that.
This is the beauty of the book too, because I think I've mentioned this to some colleagues. This could be a basis of a very interesting series of conversations in a congregation around the issues that you raise.
Your mouth to God's ear, as my friends used to say.
Well, Dr. Jonathan Marina, the co-author with Dr. Amy Gutman of this very, very exciting book, Everybody Wants to Go to Heaven, But Nobody Wants to Die. But I have to ask you, who came up with the title?
I will say that my friend and colleague and university professor Amy Gutman came up with the title.
It's a great title. It's a great title. The subtitle is Bioethics and the Transformation of Healthcare in America. Very, very timely, given what's going on in the United States. Just good luck with the book. And again, we'll include the contact information for the book in the show notes for this episode of the podcast. So, Dr. Marino, thank you very, very much. Before we close, what's the one piece of advice or, let's say, moving forward thought piece that you would want to leave people with as a result of your work in the area of bioethics? Is there one message for the future going forward?
Well, I think there's a lot, but given the time we're in now, the opportunity to do something about the healthcare system through the political process this is only going to be more ripe. Whether you think it's Medicare for all or a public option or just saving Obamacare or reforming Obamacare. You don't need me to say this because all the polling indicates that this is a top issue for Americans. But you do have to make some choices that we have failed to make. And that is actually part of the message of the title of the book. You know, we all want perfection, but, we don't want to make the hard choices. And those hard choices are now being foisted on us.
As the gates begin to close, to paraphrase a prayer book. But thank you very much.
Indeed.
Thank you, Dr. Marino. Thank you very, very much. Continued
thank
good
you,
luck.
Rabbi.
And appreciate it. I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Cheers.
Thank you. And to all of you, thank you for listening to today's edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. And again, we welcome your comments and suggestions to me, Rabbi Address, at jewishsacredaging.com. We invite you again to visit our Facebook page, Jewish Sacred Aging on Facebook. And again, we appreciate your continued support of our work. And if you'd like to make a tax-exempt donation to help further the work of Jewish Sacred Aging and the Seekers of Meaning podcast, we invite you to go to our website, jewishsacredaging.com, and click on the donate icon at the top of the page. We gratefully appreciate your support. Seekers of Meaning is recorded at the studios of Lubetkin Media Companies here in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, and is produced by Steve Lubetkin. Thank you again for listening. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address, and I look forward to greeting you on our next Seekers of Meaning. Shalom.